Good afternoon. Thank you very much, Robert. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a pleasure to be here with you. That said, if you're on the entitlements panel, you feel you drew the short straw, both in the sense, as Robert was saying, that it's very hard to say anything that hasn't been said 100 times at a gathering like this. And secondly, you're aware that all of those other 100 times have had so little impact on the world out there. Nevertheless, we soldier on. In my semi-prepared remarks, I'd like to look at the 3 basic questions. Entitlements, what they are, why they are problematic, what, if anything, can be done about them. When we use the term, we are, I think the 2 programs that come to mind for most people are Medicare and Social Security. Those are sort of the super entitlements. In the vernacular, that's what people are talking about. And there's a good reason why those are discussed. They're big programs, consequential. In fiscal year 2015, the federal government spent $1,434 billion on those 2 programs combined. That's $888 billion on Social Security, $546 billion on Medicare. Those 2 by themselves accounted for 39% of federal outlays and 8% of GDP that year. So it's hard not to talk about something that consequential that takes up that big a slice of the budget pie. And they're going to get bigger. Most of the baby boomers have yet to retire, have yet to enroll in these 2 programs. So as much as they've grown, they're going to grow further and faster in the near future. They're called entitlements, first of all, because spending the amount that government spends on them is determined by eligibility standards set long ago, either by the legislature or administrative agencies using, as we heard in the last panel, power delegated to them statutorily, and by how many people apply, which is a demographic function, how their claims are evaluated by the bureaucracy, as opposed to the amount that is spent on them being determined by the congressional appropriations process. Congress does not say we're going to spend X billion dollars a year on Social Security, and if the claims on the program exceed that amount, people receive a lovely note rather than a check at the end of the year after the money is run out. They're also, and I think in a political sense, they are entitlements sort of more fundamentally, because it's clear that in the minds of the American citizens, the strong connection between the payroll taxes and the Social Security and Medicare benefits has made them politically very, very formidable. I saw Doug Jeffrey a little bit ago. I gave a talk at Hillsdale College in 2014 after Pity Party came out. And I thought this was a not so controversial thing. I used the Office of Management and Budget terminology. Their term of art is human resources programs to talk about all of the, I said this is a good proxy for the welfare state. Medicare, Social Security, education programs, health programs, veterans. And I talked about how it went up and down. Well, he and I received dozens of angry emails from people who said, I'm on Social Security, I'm on Medicare, I am not on welfare. How dare you accuse me of being a welfare recipient? I'm getting those benefits as a result of taxes I paid, not because of some welfare program. The people did not arrive at this notion by happenstance. It was a determined, purposeful, and highly successful effort by the New Deal and the Great Society to convince people of this proposition. Some of you, there's a quote that FDR made in private, but that has become quite famous, long around 1940, after the economic ideas of John Maynard Keynes had started to gain some purchase on American liberals' thinking about economic issues. A man named Luther Gulick, who was a New Dealer who was in various commissions and programs over the course of the Roosevelt presidency, he has a private conversation with President Roosevelt. He tells FDR that the payroll tax feature of the new Social Security program, the old age and survivors insurance, was a big mistake in Keynesian terms. Social Security started collecting taxes from employees and matched by the same amount on the employer in the beginning of 1937, but it didn't pay out the first benefit until January of 1940. So when you're still in the Depression, you still have what a Keynesian would call insufficient aggregate demand. You have the government taking money out of the economy and not putting it back in. Gulick said, we should have done it a different way. And FDR said, you're probably right about the economics, but those payroll taxes were never about economics. This was politics all the way through. You set up those payroll taxes and you convince people that they are getting those benefits as a matter of legal, political, and moral right. And you do it that way, and FDR's a master politician himself said, no damn politician will ever mess with my Social Security program again. And that has basically proven to be the case. To widen the lens a bit, however, entitlements, I think there's a sense in which confining it to just those programs doesn't quite capture the scope of the problem or the situation we're in. This idea conveyed by the word entitlement, that whatever the government's doing, it should keep doing, attaches to one degree or another to just about everything modern government does. We know from the recent headlines about Obamacare, but we know it from many other things too, that one of the hardest things for modern government to do is to stop doing something it's been doing for a long time, or even in the case of Obamacare, even a few years. Things that are agreeable, that people become accustomed to, they rather quickly come to feel entitled to. And this extends beyond government spending. We're talking about, conservatives have become conversant with the term regulatory takings, but there's also regulatory givings. There are things that the government specifies that have to be done for you, like an insurance company offering you health insurance regardless of pre-existing conditions. Well, taking that away is politically very difficult. There are what are sometimes called tax expenditures, tax provisions that are favorable to one thing or another, building houses, paying mortgage interest, that kind of thing. These too become very difficult to take away. So the entitlement problem, the entitlement mentality, in a sense, applicable, it seems like, to the entirety of modern government, and is the reason why the trend line has been upward since 1932. The burden of my book, Never Enough, was that over the long term, the rate of increase per capita inflation adjusted of public spending is always higher than the per capita inflation adjusted growth of the economy. The general trend is for government to get bigger and bigger. So this, in a democracy that doesn't happen, this isn't a force of nature, but it's a force of political desire and determination. People don't like to yield things that they've been getting for a while. Why is this a bad thing? may seem self-evident, but it's worth unpacking a little bit. At the first level, entitlements are a problem because they always press upward on the available revenue resources. The taxes that have been either general taxes or the taxes specifically designated to support the entitlement programs never seem quite up to the task, and so there's always pressure for either tax increases or more borrowing by the government. Despite the New Dealers' heroic efforts to assure people, the American people, that through the Social Security Act programs, you're only getting back what you put in. This isn't charity, this isn't welfare, you paid for these benefits. The reality is that most Americans get back, certainly from those two big entitlement programs, Medicare and Social Security, a good deal more than they paid in. Eugene Sterl at the Urban Institute runs the studies that update a variety of scenarios. Single male workers, female, married, married two incomes, one income, low, medium, high wages, all the possibilities. And he looks at the lifetime value of all the payroll taxes to Social Security and Medicare that everyone would pay under each of those scenarios. He adds the value of the employee tax, the employer match. He assumes that that money is put in what is like a sort of a retirement account that earns at an interest rate 2% in excess of the inflation rate. And then he gives you sort of the value of that bundle of money when the older person, if it's in a couple, turns 65. He compares the value of that to the amount that is spent on the typical person in each situation. And in every case, the amount spent is well above the amount paid in by a factor of, in some cases, you know, a couple hundred thousand dollars, and in some cases better than $500,000. So in a sense, we've got, it's like a political machine from hell in that it gives you reliably the worst of both worlds. People are convinced they're only getting what they paid in. So they think that they're not getting charity. They are, in reality, getting more than they paid in. So what they're demanding is a matter of simply giving me back what I'm owed, much more than they're owed. So it's a great deal for each of us in our capacity as beneficiaries of Medicare and Social Security. Unfortunately, each of us is also a taxpayer, and that gap has to be covered somehow. This is a phenomenon that relates to not simply policy ineptitude, but also social trends out there. Greater longevity, more health care as a result, more expensive health care. But in addition to being a governance problem, a fiscal problem, it's a political and social problem in that the don't tread on me attitude is transformed and perverted in the entitlement society. Rugged individualism now means don't mess with my benefits rather than don't mess with me. This feistiness takes the form of saying you can't cut a dollar from anything I've been getting. And when entitlements push out the notion of natural rights, then instead of being self-reliant citizens who say, I just want to be left alone as a free person to do what I wish to do, people are staying and said, my rugged independence takes the form of saying, of demanding the benefits that continue to come to me in a never-ending flow. So it coarsens the nature of self-government, the polity, and it makes the American experiment in self-government far more precarious. How are we doing on time here?
Got about 3 minutes.
Okay. So in the final 3 minutes, let me tell you what to do about the entitlement problem. My advice is nothing. And I say that because while there could be a philosopher king answer to it that's better than doing nothing, I think the prudential situation is that, as we learned from George W. Bush in 2005, this is going to be very, very politically hard to do. It seems to me that there are other more promising battles that conservatives, conservative congressmen, conservative administrations can fight, and that the political capital burned up by trying to do something about this is not worth the benefit. I also think that we should be aware and take some in this, you know, it's a conservative gathering, so there's a lot of gloom. But I think there's reason for a certain amount of optimism in the sense that entitlements, rightly understood, I think, are all things considered a bigger problem for the left than the right. As I've hinted, the left has never, ever, ever been honest about the tax base needed to do all the wonderful, humane, generous things they want to do, which means that as these entitlement programs press upward, they crowd out other things liberals would like to do, since their agenda for what government ought to be doing is much longer than ours. A government that spends a bigger, ever-growing portion of its money on Medicare and Social Security is not ideal, but it's less bad than many of the alternatives. The other thing is that I think that the rise of what in Europe, where the welfare state is not such a controversial question, has been called welfare chauvinism, suggests that and the Trump presidency here suggests that Social Security and Medicare, in a certain sense, are actually conservative forces. I reviewed a book, I might go slightly over my time here. I reviewed a book by the lefty historian Jefferson Cowie called The Great Exception, about how, sorry fellow Marxists, the New Deal in the Great Society were not, as we thought at the time, the wave of the future. It was a parenthesis in American history. The Reagan Revolution, he said, really ought to be called the Reagan Restoration. That's the way things really are in America. And what he meant was that it turns out that this don't tread on me individualism, this reluctance to pay taxes, the skepticism about big government, that's really the way America is. And what we know, and he made an interesting point in passing, but it seemed important to him, which was that the great exception, that period of left-wing welfare state building from the New Deal to the Great Society, depended very heavily on that being the period between shutting down immigration severely in 1924 and opening up again in 1965. That degree of social solidarity that comes from a more homogenous, more culturally confident society is actually more conducive to the welfare state than greater diversity. So I think that now that diversity has become the lodestar for the left, the insistence on maintaining Social Security and Medicare because we paid into them, they're ours, it's us we're taking care of, that actually serves, for political purposes, an important conservative role, which I can make a little less cryptic, perhaps, in the Q&A. But I'll stop there, and thank you.